the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to the second CBP Media Bitcoin Bear Cave. Second in 2 days, Len. I am fatigued, Len. I feel like I'm worn down after Doomberg just absolutely taking the bat to us yesterday for an hour on all the problems with Bitcoin. How are you feeling?
I'm still ready to go. This is our fourth episode in 3 days with you and I. But then if you count the mining episode, this is my seventh going on in 3 days. So it's just... it's a marathon for me, but whatever. I'm like turbo diesel. You give me a little bit of fuel, I'm good to go for another 1,000 kilometers. Keep me going.
You got a lot of problems, buddy. That's a lot. So hello to everyone in the chat. Hello to everyone listening, watching. Our guest tonight is none other than Mike Green. He is the chief strategist and portfolio manager at Simplify. That's a new role for him. I think newish anyway. We're going to bring him on in a sec. Mike let us in on a little inside info. He was just finishing up on the barbecue close to 7 o'clock. So you know, Mike, Len, I don't know if you're familiar with his content, but a lot of debates, discussions on Bitcoin's failing shortcomings and the gaps in what we think Bitcoin is going to be successful at. Mike has a very different view. So what are you hoping to get out tonight?
A very good debate. I'm ready to argue anyone. No, I want to hear a good argument as to why Bitcoin isn't all bad. This is what I want to hear from somebody who has an opposing view to Bitcoin. My mind is wide open. I'm ready to absorb information.
For sure. Let's bring him in. He's still in Anon mode. He's in his kitchen maybe or in his backyard. I'm not sure. Mike, welcome to the program. Len is going to join you in NIM mode tonight.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about yourself, Mike. Where do you come from? What's your background? Floor is all yours, my friend.
Sure. So I am a native Californian. I grew up actually in Silicon Valley. And believe it or not, my mother did the... first patents. She was a paralegal doing the patents for companies like Atari, et cetera. I began programming computers at a very, very young age. Went to the East Coast for college, ended up going to the University of Pennsylvania, Wharton School of Business as an undergrad. Came out of there in management consulting and investment banking, and then stepped back into my programming role, built and sold a software company. It was focused on equity valuation and the tools used for valuing financial securities, and then transitioned over to the asset management side, which I've been doing for about 30 years, managing everything from separate accounts to mutual funds to hedge funds. And ultimately today, my primary focus is in the ETF space, where I work with Simplify Asset Management as the chief strategist and senior portfolio manager, helping to design ETFs that incorporate aspects that you would have traditionally associated with hedge funds. So strategies that include option overlays, et cetera.
Outstanding stuff. And you're also very well known, and we'll get right into the questions here. You're very well known for your work in the way that passives have kind of perverted market valuations. And if I have that right, Mike, I'd be curious here. Do you think that, you know, as a beginning question, do you think that Bitcoiners at least have that right, that the market structure as currently designed and as currently functioning is sort of a perverted version of what it should be as far as valuation metrics and things like that?
That part I do think is correct. And I actually think that there's a number of concerns that Bitcoiners express: frustration with the banking system, the inability to access and obtain financial services and opportunities for investment that the prior generations have benefited from. I think those are all completely legitimate complaints, right? But just like my kids can complain about not, you know, me making them clean their room, that doesn't change the reality of the situation.
It's funny enough you talk about that, but I'm not going to get into that because it really hits home for us here. But really, I want to talk about Bitcoin versus gold. And I know you tend to favor gold more than Bitcoin. You were once a Bitcoiner, but no longer. And now it looks like you might be more inclined to invest in gold. Explain your thesis in that gold is a better inflation hedge than it is Bitcoin.
Well, so let's be really clear, actually. I own gold, as I have owned Bitcoin in the past. I have no allegiance to gold. I think it's actually a simple commodity. It's one of the periodic table elements that happen to fit the requirements and utility that was required for large denomination coinage in the past. But I don't actually think I tend to agree with the claim that gold is somewhat of a barbarous relic. You know, what it has historically functioned as is a check on the power of the sovereign to print in an unlimited fashion. And again, one of the things that Bitcoiners complain about and identify as a legitimate issue, but unfortunately, I just disagree with the solution.
Okay, so let's dig into that a bit. Do you think that Bitcoin at one time, given the sort of price volatility, do you think at one time it at least had a fair claim to the inflation hedge title? Or do you think that that's more a function of broken markets than it is Bitcoin being successful?
Well, so first, let's be really straightforward, right? For the first 10 years or so of its life, Bitcoin had an intrinsic volatility and variability that meant that it didn't play any particular role other than appreciating over time, right? So to claim that it was an inflation hedge in the period from 2009 through 2019, in which generally accepted measures of inflation didn't display an awful lot of inflation, would be very disingenuous, right? In 2020, it responded extraordinarily well to the speculative environment. And I think a lot of people then took that as an indication that it was an inflation protection vehicle. Unfortunately, I think that that has largely been disproven in the behavior that we've seen over the last year.
We should be seeking alternate preferences for our currencies moving forward. And if it's not Bitcoin, then what would be the alternative? Because it looks like that, you know, the central banks are going to be coming up with CBDCs, but it's just a continuation of the existing US dollar or name your national currency. So it's really not going to be solving many of the problems. In fact, it may just create a whole new set of problems like privacy issues or a whole bunch more. What are your thoughts on?
You're talking about CBDCs or you're talking about Bitcoin?
Well, CBDC.
I think the question is, does Bitcoin have, in your view, Mike, maybe not right now or maybe sometime in the future, the potential to function as a currency? I think that there's some discussion, and we talked about this a little bit with Thunberg as well, some discussion around the likelihood that Bitcoin, as it's currently, you know, constructed, functions as a peer-to-peer currency the way that the US dollar does, vis-a-vis Lightning Network and other second layer solutions. Do you have a view on that? And, you know, if it's not going to be Bitcoin, do you think the US dollar hegemony continues into the distant future? Is there some kind of, you know, expiry date on that in your view? What do you think?
Well, so a couple of quick things. One, you made a statement, we should be seeking, right? And so my question just very quickly is, why do you say that?
Len, why do you say we should be seeking an alternate to the US dollar?
Well, it's not me. This is what you've stated in a previous interview, is that we should be seeking alternatives rather than using the US dollar or anything else. We're just trying to find something that's different. And you're stating
I've never said that. I didn't say that we should be seeking. I said that people do seek. And I'm asking you why you made the statement that we should be seeking.
Well, the US dollar is weakening by the day, and over time it's no longer going to be the global currency. And so we should, I would imagine, seek something else to help replace the US dollar, relying on politicians to give us the guidance and act upon properly. Given the fact what's happened in the past few years, I have little faith in them doing so.
Okay, so just very quickly, you're saying that you believe that we should be seeking alternatives to the US dollar because it has been losing value on a steady basis? Is that your statement?
The continuing printing of it, the fact that it's no longer going to be used for settling trade oil and for settling oil with US dollars. There's a number of different factors that's showing that the US dollar is on the decline and it's no longer going to have the same strength it had initially. And I have little faith in the Fed providing us with the guidance going forward that would keep me to have my value moving forward, my time and effort secured in a currency that is not going to be debased.
Okay, so just very quickly, there is no indication that oil is not going to be settled in U.S. dollars. There is indication that there are alternative means of settlement being explored. You're referring to, for example, what Russia, China, and a few other countries are trying to do. But that doesn't mean that you can't use the U.S. dollar to buy oil. That just means that you might be able to use something else to settle that transaction. Is that does that feel like an inaccurate statement to you?
No, that's perfectly accurate. But it seems to me if that's the case, then the value of the U.S. dollar should erode over time because there's less demand for it.
And what is your evidence that there is less demand for it? The fact that an alternative emerges doesn't necessarily mean that there is less demand, right? Beef has emerged as an alternative to chicken, or more accurately, actually, chicken has emerged as an alternative to beef, and yet demand for both have grown over time.
So you're saying that, just to want to clarify, that the fact that there's going to be less oil settled in U.S. dollars is not going to impact, or it may not impact very much, so the price of the U.S. dollar, the value of the U.S. dollar?
Well, we're seeing the exact opposite, right? The value of the U.S. dollar has actually been rising over the period that we're discussing the emergence of these alternative forms of settlement.
Yeah, the Dixie is strengthening. Mike, do you think that's a function of just the euro showing weakness for, you know, any number of reasons? Do you think that's a function of people just understanding that, or thinking anyway, that the U.S. dollar debasement policies that we've seen over the last, you know, last several years at least, but certainly, you know, more amplified in the media the last 2 or 3 years, which do you think is playing a bigger role in that?
So what I would suggest is that when you describe the dynamics of money printing, right, or an expansion of the quantity of U.S. dollars, that you guys are focused only on one aspect of that printing. So the value of a monetary system, right, the real opportunity that is created in the monetary system is that it is stable enough that other people are encouraged to extend credit in those terms, right? That's what a banking system is it's fundamentally a franchise system, similar to a McDonald's operation.
Okay, so let's...
Everyone burgers that wants burgers, and so I go out and I create franchises, allowing them to take some of the individual risk in building a location and extending the service of delicious burgers to everyone on the planet, right? Billions and billions served. Sometimes a McDonald's franchise will overexpand, right? And when that McDonald's franchise overexpands, then you enter into a situation in which that location could very well enter into distress, right? That's what happens in a banking crisis, is the credit that has been extended in U.S. dollar terms suddenly discovers that there are not adequate quantities of dollars to make good on all of those promises. And in that situation, what you're seeing when the Fed steps in to quote unquote bail out the system or to print more dollars is what they're actually doing is increasing the quantity of dollars that they're providing relative to their franchisees. Right? They're saying, well, that franchisee can't actually make good on their commitment to provide you with tasty, delicious burgers. And so we're going to provide you with tasty, delicious burgers so that the system continues to function.
Right.
Does that make sense? Okay.
No, it does. It does. Mike, in that vein, I've heard you discuss in the past the need for maybe not disrupting the sort of, you know, the steadfastness of the U.S., but rather the sort of ease of anticipation, the importance of disrupting things like knowing that policy will change in a way that makes, you know, markets happy, for example. I think I heard you mention on a podcast, I can't remember if it was Grant Williams or another, that it'd be interesting if the Federal Reserve had a random number generator at every meeting, and based on the outcome of the RNG, they would either raise or cut 25 basis points just to halt speculation. I thought that was an interesting take.
Not to halt, but just to reduce the level and precision of speculation, right?
Right.
It's the classic expression. It's not what you know. It's not what you don't know that gets you. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so, right? And so if I am overly confident in my extension of credit, and let's pretend that I'm, I don't know, let's call us Celsius, for example, right? And I decide to extend credit to another party with high confidence that they're going to return it, and they don't, right? And I've overly speculated. Well, the risk is that the system comes to a screeching halt because now I can't repay my liabilities to other people in the process. And that's really what we're referring to, right? So it's the same thing.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And that's why I said I like the take. I'm curious, though, you know, do you think that when I think about Bitcoin, Mike, I don't necessarily view Bitcoin as this savior that a lot of maxis think it is. I don't necessarily view it as, you know, 100% allocation, which we'll talk about in a bit. But I do see it as something that could contribute to that kind of disruption. It's sort of this relative unknown that may change behavior in investors. This understanding that there's not going to be more help coming if you make a mistake, or if enough people make a mistake, there's not going to be more help coming to sort of remedy the ill-advised speculation. Why do you not share that view? Is that something you've thought about at all?
Oh, absolutely. And it was part of my original interest in the concept of Bitcoin, right? There's something incredibly powerful and almost romantic about the idea of having a alternate new commodity that is introduced that has an issuance schedule that is fundamentally finite in a world in which population really is not expanding anymore, right? Or certainly not in a meaningful way, right? That's actually a really interesting idea. The idea behind gold is that it places limitations on how much of it you can theoretically create, right? But it can continually expand because ultimately the quantity of gold, certainly relative to the population of humans, is functionally infinite. Our accessing it is just a function of human ingenuity. We've done that repeatedly in time by changing our mining processes, by changing our refining processes, et cetera. Right. So Bitcoin is actually quite interesting, and I understand why you guys are interested in it, because it has an issuance schedule that implies that it's finite. And so you could theoretically enter into a framework in which there is a fixed quantity of Bitcoin per capita, and that remains relatively stable over time. Right. So that's actually very interesting. The problem is twofold. One is, even in that system, you can't actually allow that system to consolidate in a way that naturally accumulates or naturally happens in a game with a finite quantity of something, right? It becomes like a game of Monopoly, which we all know is played to an end state as compared to a continuing game. And that's really the critical difference. If you think about a game like Monopoly, it ends at some point and everybody, one person has everything. That's the whole point of the title of the game, right? But that's not a useful outcome in human society. And that actually sits at the core of my objection to how Bitcoin has been constructed.
Do you just think that do you just think that in that sort of end game scenario that there's not going to be like the transactional sort of volume will decrease to zero over time? Help me sort that out. Flesh that out for me.
Yeah, so that's actually exactly what happens. And there's an alternate view of how interest rates are set, right? This is actually Keynes prior to the general theory of money, in which it's recognized effectively that an interest rate is simply the inverse of the velocity of money, right? It's not so much the price of money, as some people think about it, as much as it is the price of obtaining access to money over a period of time. And so if you have a fixed quantity against an expanding population and or an infinite number of needs, or a system that has new entrants who enter into that system without endowment, in other words, a child is born into the world without access to the same resources of somebody who has worked, accumulated those resources over a lifetime, right? That means that the cost of capital for that child is infinitely high in that system. That's a terrible outcome. We want the exact opposite. That's actually part of the point of a state, is to encourage the access of capital to that younger generation. Right? We look to old people to facilitate the transfer. And again, this is one of the very legitimate complaints that the millennials have about the current system, and the millennials and even those even younger than them, right? Who are able to look at the system and say, this thing is fucked up. Right? I'm never going to be able to participate in the way that the boomers were. I don't have access to the land. I don't have access to the educational resources at low cost. I don't have access to the opportunities that existed for those that came before me. Well, that's a failure of our state. It's not a failure of our monetary system.
Okay. So just one more follow-up there. I'm sure you have thought about this already, but I'd love to hear you talk about it. Mm-hmm. I think on one hand, we agree that there's this problem with sort of currency as currently constructed, right? This sort of fiat economy. And on the other hand, we disagree on the on that Bitcoin will eventually have transaction volumes that decline to zero. So what is the how in your view should we ensure that, you know, we don't have this problem where millennials, for example, my generation, have issues garnering capital and issues with, you know, quality of available opportunity without also debasing currency at this rate that seems to be accelerating at a, you know, a more rapid pace by the quarter. And I don't see any end in sight. I don't know if you do, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
Sorry about that. I lost your lost you for a second. Could you repeat that? How do we deal with a system in which, you know, we can you're saying that we disagree in terms of the dynamics of transactions. I do want to explore that as we go forward. But you were saying, is there an alternate way of thinking about it or fixing it, or have I considered something?
Yeah, like what I mean, I think we agree that there's a problem. I think that Bitcoin can play a role. Like I said, I don't think it's the sort of golden goose. But I'm curious, in a world where I think all three of us agree that there's an issue with the sort of debasement of currency, and that debasement of currency, you know, certainly causes hardships for millennials. But if we get away from that debasement of currency, we'll use millennials again here, then it's even more difficult for them. So where is the fix for that in the current monetary regime? Is there one that you've considered?
So I just want to actually, okay, so a couple of quick things. One, why do you think actually the debasement of currency is a problem for millennials?
Well, I think about the way that in my case, it's difficult for me to save in dollars, for example, in the loonie. I mean, we could talk about any first world currency, but in my view, and maybe this is me and my naivete, Mike, but I look at the way that I spend my time. I have a full-time job. You know, Len and I do this show for shits and giggles. We make a little bit of money off this. But it seems that no matter how much I make, I have to also employ either the help of someone else or do it myself as far as managing money to keep up with the monetary policy decisions of my government. And actually, really, it's not only my government, but your government as well. I think everyone's keeping up with your government more than their own in the current state of affairs.
I just want to add, it's not just the millennials, because think about somebody that's young. They have a lot of opportunity to still earn money, regardless if it's debased or not. But when you're older, you lose that opportunity because you're relying on what you've saved. And if what you saved is then being lost in value due to whatever debasement, well, then you're really doubly screwed or multiply.
Another good point. So
I actually want to emphasize that, right? And I've made this point repeatedly. Inflation is not so much a problem for the young because you're constantly earning real returns, right? You're constantly benefiting from the fact that your capital is real capital. Human labor is real capital. Your frustration is that some of the assets and some of the things that you want, your belief is they are inappropriately priced relative to your earning capacity. Now, I don't know whether that's a function of you didn't study the right things in school, you didn't earn the right degree. I can't possibly know those things, right? You seem like a very bright, very enjoyable individual, but I can't know the particulars of your circumstance. But there's plenty of young, successful, you know, computer science engineers, lawyers, doctors, et cetera, that are capable of buying homes in, you know, reasonably priced cities throughout Canada, et cetera. They may not be able to live in the Toronto metro area, but if they want to move to Saskatoon, they probably can.
We both live like not too far from Toronto, so I don't want to give myself up. But yeah, I mean, it's not, again, like my view is not specifically that it's all millennials, right? Or it's all people that are, you know, walking around with underwater basket weaving degrees, which is a problem that we talk about all the time on this program.
You get 10K off nowadays.
Yeah, I know. You stole that from me,
by the way. I used that term. But underwater
really?
Yeah, basket weaving, yes.
Did you come up with that? Yeah?
Yes, that's mine. All right, that's okay. It is. Go back and listen to my podcast. I talk about it all the time, but yes.
I don't know where I heard that first, but anyway, yeah, it's a great saying. I'm happy to give you credit for it. So I'm not saying it's everybody, but I do think that there's at least some fairly held understanding that most people now, and whether that's most university grads, most college grads, people who didn't graduate, whatever, in a society where, as you said, it's a state failure if resources are not available to a huge swath of the population, specifically the young. I think you mentioned, you know, like a newborn, for example. You know, the state should be, in my view, I don't want to speak for Len too, doing things that contribute to the sort of, I don't want to say ease of life, but opportunity for people that don't necessarily inherit generational wealth, for example, or don't necessarily inherit great genetics, for example, things of this nature, right? Things that are difficult subjects, of course. But anyway, we'll switch to another topic here. Mike,
I don't want to actually leave that, right? Because I actually want to emphasize that that is actually a really critical observation that you just made. It is the role of the state to make sure that those individuals have the opportunity to participate. But that is a rarity. It's an extraordinary rarity throughout the history of humankind that an individual would be given that opportunity, right? Those were rights that were reserved for nobility. Those were rights that were reserved for the children of the very wealthy, right? The opportunity to attend university at all is something that wasn't available for most people prior to the 20th century.
I think even in the last 50 years, really, that's only been the case, right? Something like that. Yeah. No, you're right about that.
We're looking at all these things and we're saying, well, these are human rights. No, they're not at all. All right, these are the direct evolution of the tremendous success of those who came before us. And we've now had, give or take, 50 to 70 years of piss-poor stewardship. And our complaint is about the monetary system, not about the piss-poor stewardship. It just feels like that's actually a cop-out. Mm. Right? And so the entire narrative behind Bitcoin is, well, I can't do anything about that, so let me bitch about this.
So if we have been poorly led or given the wrong direction, if you're given the ultimate power or magic wand to fix things, what would you suggest is the path forward?
That's where the fixing the money comes in, right? Go ahead with money. That. Actually, what money actually is a mechanism for me to convey my desires and wants in a manner that is consummate with my purchasing power, right? I'm able to say to the market, hey, I really want a hamburger today, right? Millions of other people around the world said the exact same thing. And as a result, it's waiting for me in the grocery store when I show up and use my fiat dollars to purchase that hamburger, right? That's what a market economy or a market system is. It doesn't require somebody in a bureaucratic position in the government somewhere saying, we're going to make sure that X quantity of burgers are produced because, you know, Comrade Stalin says so. Right? Like, it relies on a profit incentive. And what you're describing is a perversion of that system that can be created when there isn't a sufficient check on the ability of the government to hand out those fiat dollars to special interest groups that are then being used to either stay in power, get in power, et cetera. And that's really the story of the last 70 years, is we were terrified coming back from World War II that the soldiers that we deployed to fight against fascism and communism in the period after that were going to turn against us. And so we bought them off. And now you're pissed because they have too much of it.
Do you think, Mike, I'm being inundated in the chat here, that we should be asking you, why not both? Why not some combination of the US dollar and Bitcoin? As you know, I don't want to say monetary reserve asset again. I think saying Bitcoin is going to be the ultimate monetary reserve asset, at least officially, is a bit of a stretch, to say the least. But in your view, is there room for both to exist in harmony in a place like the United States, Canada, the UK, et cetera?
Well, to the extent that you're talking about a speculative asset, I have no issue with it, right? I have huge problems with the way it is marketed and the way that it is presented, which is why my problem with Bitcoin is large maxis. More than happy to have a discussion with you in a free and open format about this. But when people turn around and tell me that the future of society is Bitcoin, that it's already been solved, that there is no problems with Bitcoin, that, you know, have fun staying poor unless you get on board and mortgage your house, et cetera, right? Then I get really pissed, because that's just fundamentally fraud. You can't possibly know those things.
No, there's right? no so, doubt about that.
Okay. But you guys are doing a terrible job of policing yourselves against that.
Tell me more. What I actually have here in my notes. Yeah.
Minute Mike Saylor came out and said you should mortgage your house, you guys should have immediately said that guy is a fraud.
I think it, you know, to our credit, I don't want to tap myself on the back here too much, but we take a lot of shit, Mike, from people who watch this show pretty regularly, that we invest in stocks. We have, you know, we own our homes, for example, which a lot of Bitcoin maxis would call a shitcoin. I think it rather incorrectly and rather naively. You know, all things like that. And so one of the questions I have for you here is, and maybe we can talk about this now, I think it's a great segue. I also believe that some people who are influencers, talking heads, I don't know what to call them, guys like Pomp, for example, I think they're misrepresenting the risks of Bitcoin. In your view, Mike, what are the biggest risks that these guys are misrepresenting in the interest of just pumping their own bags? And that's exactly what they're fucking doing, by the way. People listening and watching, we talked about this on the show before. It's not news to you if you're a viewer and listener. So, Mike, what do you think the biggest risks are? And how are they being misrepresented by these guys? And what do you think the consequences for something like that should be these days?
So in the simplest form, and I've come out and directly said this, and it's terrible when you have an individual like Anthony Pompliano, who was a soldier for the United States, served with honor, right? But what he's actually doing is he's spreading untruths about how the system works. And that in turn is creating further distrust of a system that is already frayed and stretched for very obvious reasons, right? We have engaged in unsustainable behavior. We did buy off the older generation. We bought domestic tranquility in the form of pension systems, et cetera, right? Like we made terrible policy choices. We should acknowledge those policy choices, but to turn around and say something like the US dollar is collapsing and it's a fundamental fraud and the only way that you can save yourself is to buy Bitcoin, that's just setting up conditions for people to respond in the same way that they have to Ponzi after Ponzi after Ponzi in history, which is through violence and civil unrest.
If I could spin it a different way, why not purchase a home or multiple homes? That's another way to hedge against the US dollar.
And in the process of doing that, you actually create forms of positive investment, right? By purchasing multiple homes, you can then rent them out to a younger generation that might not otherwise be able to accumulate the capital to buy them. We're actually seeing the direct byproduct of people choosing not to do that through a period of concern and fears of speculation. And also, candidly, particularly in places like Canada, the unwillingness of the government to use KYC and anti-money laundering laws to recognize that a sizable fraction of your housing activity is driven by the Chinese and the Russians escaping their own oppressive systems.
But yeah. on that notion, if people are incentivized or looking to purchase homes as a way to hedge against their currency, that's an admission that the currency itself is on its way down, because if it wasn't, they would find some other means, perhaps even stuffing the money under their mattress just by holding a hard asset. Now, granted, you talked about that there's a future potential revenue generation through renting, but taking that out of the equation, because that's just relatively a small piece of the pie.
But it's not, right? So the number of homes that are left vacant, unless you're actually hiding your capital from the Chinese Communist Party, is relatively low. Right. The idea that people go out and speculate and buy multiple homes and don't choose to rent them out either over Airbnb or to individuals for rent, et cetera, like, this is not really true.
No, you're right on that. It would be rather small, but I'm looking at the rate of return, and maybe I'm kind of skewed given the fact that I live just outside of Toronto and the price of property over here skyrocketed multiple compared to just about anything else. So, and people that have done so, they, even if they've risked a lot of their capital, they came out ahead just because of the fact that the price of homes went up. And that's, I would say, partially or mostly to do with the fact that Canadian dollar has taken a dive. And so,
yeah, that actually doesn't match up, right? Because the real price of houses in Canada has risen, right? So more than the inflationary rate, more than the cost of labor, et cetera. Right. What has actually happened in Canada is that you have a permitting process and a infrastructure development process in which everybody wants to be within 100 miles of the U.S. border in one form or another. And I'm saying that in part to be intentionally inflammatory and piss off as many of your listeners as I possibly can, because it makes for good radio.
Do you think that's the thing you've said so far that's going to piss them off? You're like 35 minutes in here, things that are going to piss them off. They won't even hear that.
Yeah, well, you know, just emphasize that again, right? But the simple point, and I'm really not actually trying to piss people off. I'm actually trying to be very, very blunt and plain with you guys, because I think that we're losing something when a younger generation tries to opt out in the way that you guys are describing. All right. Yeah, so when you said it would make perfect sense for people to hoard their money under their mattress, that's actually exactly what you're doing. And that's really the core of the issue. What I want you guys to do is I want you guys to demand better of your government and of yourselves, and to say, you know what, I'm going to actually invest and build a new house so that somebody can afford it. And if, by the way, the idea is that house to build is so expensive, then let's figure out better ways of doing it. Let's go vertical. Let's create land and skyscrapers. Oh my gosh, that was an innovation that happened in the 20th century, late 19th century. Right. That dramatically expanded the quantity of land and the number of people that could live in downtown Toronto. And as a result, what happened to the price of land in downtown Toronto? It exploded. It went from potato farms to financial centers.
Yeah, there's been obviously a shift in that regard. Mike, I have a few more questions here, and then I'm going to hit you with, like I mentioned, one fun one to get you going. I can't let you go without telling us about the risks present in Tether. We had, obviously, Doomberg yesterday talk about some of that stuff. You've done a real deep dive on it. And for people who haven't listened, whether you agree with Mike tonight or not, I'm certain many of you will not. There's a really good debate between Mike and sort of now disgraced former Bitcoin star Nick Carter on the sort of, I don't know what you would call it. Yeah, the quality of the Tether audits, quote unquote audits and things like that. Talk to me a bit about that, Mike. What are the risks there? Because we think there are risks as well. I do believe there are risks there too.
Well, just very quickly, I was unaware that Nick Carter is now disgraced. So that's interesting.
Oh my God, yeah. He couldn't be more disgraced. Are you kidding? The guy's, he's talking about how his star is going to continue to ascend. It's a goddamn joke. Anyway, whatever.
That's really interesting. I was totally unaware of that development. Well, look, I actually think that debate is interesting because if you go back and you listen to it, this is a couple of years ago, nothing has fundamentally changed, right? The community of Bitcoiners have been more than happy enough to accept the fact that because Tether has continued to hold its parity, that somehow everything's okay, right? They have failed to produce an audit. They have failed to provide clear description of where the money is being invested, right? We have never seen any of the leadership. We have, other than the chief technologist, right? Like everything here screams fraud. And yet the community that is, all about openness and transparency and everything needs to be on the blockchain seems completely content to allow this to persist as the central mechanism for transfer on-ramp and off-ramp to the fiat system. Like that's insane. You guys are sitting there with money market funds, which is what Tether is, right? It's the equivalent of when I buy stocks, if I sell stocks, I don't receive deposits in my bank. I hold a money market instrument. When you do that, you want to know that the assets that you're holding are actually secure and safe. We have various forms of regulations in the United States that require funds that are significantly larger in most situations than Tether on an individual basis, right? If I look at the money market funds of a Vanguard or others, they can tell me instantaneously every single day exactly what they own. They're required to by law. They carry insurance against it. And yet you can't obtain that in this new world that you guys are creating. And everybody seems okay with it. It's completely insane.
Yeah, I think there's obvious shortcomings there. Len, go ahead.
No, you're reiterating exactly what a lot of people are saying about Tether. And I have said a lot of negativity towards stablecoins as well. But in the end, that should theoretically have pumped up the price of Bitcoin somewhat. And I'm not sure exactly how much it would have. But in terms of the actual asset and even the network itself, without Tether, it's still debatable. And I think somebody could make a strong debate. There's still value there because Tether itself just only drives up the price of Bitcoin. So it doesn't change the fundamentals of Bitcoin, in my opinion. So
again, like, what are the fundamentals of Bitcoin in your mind?
The scheduled release, the fact there's only going to be 21 million. There's no way that somebody or an entity, government, whatever, could change anything. It's immutable code.
So first of all, it's not immutable code, right? There have been multiple changes to the code over the past decade, right? Everything ranging from debates around what the block size is to debates around the issuance schedule to return it. We've had it in things like Ethereum, et cetera, where we've actually forked to undo transactions, right? So, and again, I understand that's not Bitcoin per se, right? But there have been multiple changes to the code that have occurred. They've occurred in a consensus format. That's not the same thing as immutable code. So the whole point of a 51% attack is that it is a mechanism for using quote unquote consensus for changing those dynamics.
This I want to focus on. Do you believe there's still an opportunity to do an attack like that on Bitcoin? Because I think that the cost in a previous interview, you were saying it was around $7-8 million, but the price obviously has gone up since then. But given the fact it's still
actually the price has gone down from that point.
Ah, but I've looked at the U.S. government, and they fought wars for far, far more, trillions, in fact, if you looked at how much they spent in Afghanistan and
that's exactly the point. If anyone decided to get serious about it, and by the way, you know exactly how that is calculated, right? How many Bitcoin are released every single day?
900.
900. What is the price of Bitcoin?
20,000.
Just make it 20,000 or to make our lives easy, right? So we're talking $180 million every single day. How many days are there in a year?
365 or 366.
Multiply 365 by 20 million. That is the total expenditure on Bitcoin security every single year.
Yeah.
Right? Half of that, 51%, is required to break the system.
Plus the hardware, right? That's one thing I think a Bitcoiner say a lot of, is that the hardware is really where the hangup is. Do you have that view as well or no?
So I think that there are components of that. But again, remember, hardware actually can be taken. Governments can confiscate hardware.
That's a good point. Yeah, I hadn't. Energy. We talked about this before. Governments, the thing is that for me, the risk factor, if this becomes too big and too, you know, if there's some code base change that allows for privacy in a way that's really detrimental to governments being able to look into illicit activities, for example. And I think we're getting close to that in a couple of different places, but story for another time. I think that governments, it's maybe not irresponsible, but it's naive for Bitcoiners to say, well, look, you know, if the network is co-opted, we'll just fork, or if the network is co-opted, we'll just do this or do that. The fact of the matter is the network, although digitally native, runs on physical hardware, runs on commodity energy, runs on things that the government absolutely can and has taken in the past. And that's, to me, that's a big issue. I think that there's some focus, especially in the last 2 years, on trying to influence legislators, elected officials, at least. I don't think we're going to turn Yellen or Powell anytime soon. But, you know, I think that like there's some focus on going to legislators saying, look, this thing makes sense for X, Y, and Z reasons. Do you agree? Do you disagree? And we go through the political process, right? I think that's a fair criticism, Mike. And I think that more people should take that seriously. I truly do. If you're listening and watching, I think you should take that more seriously. I want to ask you two more questions, Mike, the same ones we asked Doom to finish yesterday. What would change your view as far as Bitcoin being a legitimate asset or asset class, I guess, depending on how you want to qualify it?
So again, I have no issue with Bitcoin as an asset or crypto as an asset class. Like nothing is required to change my view. The question that you're asking me is, I believe, what would cause me to believe that Bitcoin could become the next reserve asset, right? The global currency base or the global reserve asset.
Or at least exist alongside without fear of, let's say, government shutdown, something of that nature.
Well, that one's very straightforward, right? If you guys stop talking about it becoming the global reserve asset and accept that it's a speculative asset that you guys want to play around with, you're free to do whatever you want. Nobody's going to stop you from doing that, right? Nobody has stopped you so far.
No, you're right about that. Okay, so that's one. And then as far as the messaging, Mike, I think we found some common ground here. We disagreed on a number of things as well. What do you think that Bitcoiners, not maxis, not these like zealous, pillow screamers talking about upending the system, but rather I think about guys like me and Len. You know, we own our homes, have stock portfolios, things of that nature. What are folks in our shoes getting right as far as messaging, and what are we getting wrong?
I mean, the critical point, hold on one sec. I think my wife just came home. Give me one second.
No problem.
Joey, do you want me to start juggling?
No, I was going to start doing a little dance number or something. I love when I can hear the dog. Listen, when I'm doing French in the mornings, the dog is the absolute bane of my existence. Every time somebody walks by the fucking door, the guy's barking. Okay, Mike's back. Go ahead, Mike.
Sorry about that, guys. Yeah, no, the dogs came down to see me. They were excited to see me after going upstairs to make sure that my wife walked in the door appropriately. So what I would broadly argue that you guys are getting wrong, right, is this issue of, is this system actually innovative? Does it encourage the behavior that you want out of society? I have a podcast that I did with Alexander Fernandez on video games Real Talk. And I think that's actually the most valuable one to turn to and try to understand my core critique. The primary benefit of gold, I alluded to before, because it is a true commodity, a true raw material that can be extracted from the earth, if it rises in value, there is an incentive for people to figure out how to produce more of it, right? That creates a natural feedback loop in the system in which resources can be devoted to generating the monetary good, or then they can be used to exploit other types of goods, right? So if the price of gold falls, guess what? You're going to have people build more houses because the price of houses have risen relative to gold, right? It has a natural feedback loop associated with that. The quote-unquote innovation associated with Bitcoin, in which the issuance schedule is fixed and responds to the technology innovation effort by becoming more difficult and therefore reducing, is designed to mimic mining, but it actually fails in its reward for human ingenuity. All it does is create competition for the release of a finite schedule of a finite quantity of a commodity, as compared to actually expanding that quantity.
I have one follow-up question, not really directly related to your answer there, but I'm curious to know if you could give us an idea in the next 10 years, what's your prediction, what's going to happen with Bitcoin? Not the price, because obviously who the heck knows what's going to happen there, but where do you see Bitcoin will be in 10 years? Do you think it's going to be, it will fizzle out, or it will still remain as it, in its current state, as you've suggested, the speculative asset? What do you think it's going to be in 10 years?
Well, I think it'll be ultimately a much reduced speculative asset, right? It'll be like Beanie Babies. And I understand that pisses people off when I say that, right? Beanie Babies still exist. You can still trade them. You can still store them. You can still argue that they retain value in one form or another. And I guarantee you there's somebody out in the audience who's saying, Beanie Babies are coming back, baby, I tell you.
I got a lot of them right there.
Yeah. So, like, that unfortunately is the direction I think Bitcoin will go.
That's fair.
Okay. Mike, we asked Doomberg yesterday as a last question whether or not he thought he could beat you in a 40-yard dash. What do you think his answer was?
Not a chance.
I don't know. He really went pretty deep, and I think he did eventually give it to you just on the basis of your son recently getting into the Naval Academy and whatever that means for your genetics compared to his. But he didn't really give it to you right away. So you say not a chance. Now I'm going to ask you a different question. You kind of pussyfoot around this when I hear you talk, but other people bring it up. How tall are you, Mike?
I'm 6'3", 6'4".
Okay. And, you know, I've only seen you here for the last little while. I've seen you a few other places, and you spent the first 20 minutes of the show cooking what sounded like a monster meal. And it doesn't look like you miss many meals, Mike, I got to say. So your question is not about foot speed. It's what is the most you've ever bench pressed? One rep max.
340.
340. 40. Jesus Christ. Oh my God. I'm lucky water if I can get to like two wheels. I got to wrap my wrist, man. Oh my goodness. Okay. So that's okay. We'll have to bring that to the next guest. Maybe we'll see if they bench more than 340. Somehow I doubt it. Mike,
let's just be clear. That was 30 years ago, but yeah.
No problem, buddy. No problem.
Tell people where they can wait, by the way, Joey. Well,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mike, tell people where they can find out more about you, Simplify, all that stuff. Floor's all yours.
You can find me at Simplify's website, www.simplify.us, not .com. And then, of course, you can find me on Twitter, ProfPlum99, ProfPlum99. Weird historical accident. I look nothing like my avatar, which is Vicini from The Princess Bride, an entirely different story. Those are the inconceivable. Those are the two easiest places to find me.
Good. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Mike Green. Take care, everyone. See you next time.
Thanks a lot.